This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Mecklenburg County commissioners give themselves what some see as an eye-opening raise. CMS decides on its own policy on the use of bathrooms by transgender students, and it doesn't square with HB 2. Efforts to cancel the I-77 toll lane project hit a dead end in the state Senate. Ramsey Creek Park has become so popular in the short time it's been opened that park officials are already raising the entrance fee or talking about it. The FAA updates a policy that leaves control of the Charlotte Airport in the city's hands, and a young woman has died after possibly coming into contact with the rare brain-eating amoeba at the U.S. National Whitewater Center. Those and other stories on our weekly local news roundup. This hour, WFAE's Tom Bullock is here along with Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV. He's on your side, by the way. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, is here.
I'm not on your side.
I know that. And so is Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, or you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. It was front page news on Wednesday after floating the idea of giving themselves the raise. The Mecklenburg County Commission decided to go ahead and give themselves a raise. The vote was 6-2, with one person being absent. Bill James wasn't there. Their take-home pay, this is very complicated. Their take-home pay now goes from $30,252 to $43,371. But we're not really, there's so much more to this.
Yeah.
The pay is up 43%.
Well, officially, the members of the city county, or sorry, the county commission will tell you that their actual pay increase was only
3%.
Right.
Yes.
And that's actually true, except for reality getting in the way, because what they also get are a combination of stipends and spending allowances, basically expense accounts that are structured in a way where you get the money up front and then you pay, you know, you basically submit receipts, but you get to keep what you don't spend.
Mm.
And that is where this stuff.
This is a lot of money, because it's $8,000 in general expenses plus $4,410, where they got that figure, I don't know, for
service fees. It's like Ticketmaster.
For technology, and $4,000 for a car allowance. That's $16,000.
That's right.
$16,010 or something.
and the key thing here is they get all that money every year. And they get it up front. So it is not your classic, no matter
whether they spend that much or
exactly
not.
Exactly the point I was going to make, Eric, because it doesn't matter whether or not they spend it. They get this money up front, and then they can spend it, and whatever they don't spend, they keep. So it is de facto salary.
It would be difficult.
Which is why it feels like a pay raise.
Yeah.
Well, it would be
difficult to spend, I think, unless you bought a new iMac every year, $4,000 on technology. Do you have to spend that money on technology? The answer probably is no, because you get to keep the money anyway.
Yep. This is probably a dumb question, but that's what I specialize in. Would your smartphone fall under the technology?
I suspect they probably put that under
there. Okay, so your monthly bill could go in there as well.
Your internet bill, your computer, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
$4,000 is the car allowance to buy a car, to lease a car for car expenses?
Whatever they want that has to do with road travel. It could be buying snacks on the road.
What other general expenses could amount to $8,000 for a county commissioner?
Travel. Right.
Well, and
going to conferences.
And there are, I guarantee you, if pressed, they would come up with a whole kind of general set of categories that could fall into that. The question isn't why it's there. It's the way that it was phrased. And there's another thing here that I find a little eye opening, and that is an actual travel expense. Like we've been talking about the $4,000, Mike, for the car, but there is an actual travel line expense where if they go to a conference or they go to this or they go to that on official county business. And in the past, that has been capped at $6,500 a year, which is not an insignificant sum. That cap is now gone. So one thing I know I'm going to be watching for is, are we suddenly seeing an upswing in, boy, that conference sounds really great. I'm going to head over there.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing really is kind of, well, our word in our editorial responding to it was appalling. It really is that they would, I guess, understand, and you get the sense that they understood that nobody really other than them thought this was a good idea, and maybe the county staff, I suppose.
Well,
and they did it anyway. I mean, just
we had already had what, a week or two of backlash of, really, are you considering this? Yeah. When, you know, and the instant comparison drawn by the Observer and others is, of course, what they had just told the school system, which is, hey, look, you've got to live within your means. You can't come to us at this point asking for extra. And then they turn around and do this. And even though there is a disparity in the amount of money, obviously, the optics, as people in the political game like to term it, are terrible.
Well, that's exactly, you know, we've gotten emails from viewers. I got one just yesterday that said, look, the county, a part-time county commissioner is going to make $43,000. I mean, that's a good-paying teacher salary in North Carolina right now.
Yeah, and or it's frankly more than a sheriff's deputy makes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, in all honesty, they know that. Do I believe that our county commissioners are truly just part-timers? Realistically, no. I mean, it is actually an involved job, but it is an elected position that they ran for.
Right.
They knew what they were doing, and you know, I can't think of a single one that actually doesn't have a secondary source of income. Think of the sheriff's deputy. You know, they don't. This is their primary source of income, and when your county commission is getting more than the people who are there to protect, and the county commission is not a full-time job, That's troubling.
At least one commissioner, I didn't hear the whole thing, but at least one commissioner seemed a little put off by some of the reaction to themselves giving themselves a raise. Commissioner Vilma Leek referenced some of the reaction that she had been getting prior to the vote.
Emails that I have received saying to me how nasty I am to ask for a pay raise, how dirty you are to ask for a pay raise. Who do you think you are?
And she went on to say that her job may be considered part-time, but it's actually a full-time position in terms of how many hours she spends working. No doubt that is true, but the reality is it's a part-time job.
Yeah, well, and the other thing is, look, it is difficult for political groups to ever give themselves a raise. That's never going to go well. No one's going to pat you on the back and say, job well done. But I think it is the percentage, the amount here that is really, you know, 40% plus. I don't know many people that walk in for the annual evaluation and the boss says, you know what, how about 40%? That would be a good number.
Well, and compare this to another part-time body, the State General Assembly, right, House and Senate, which actually takes up a larger percentage of time of these elected officials.
And takes them away largely from their home base.
Exactly. And they're still stuck making like $25,000, less than. It's not $25,000, but significantly less than these folks. And they actually do need a raise, and they're hesitant to do it because of the optics and because it would look bad.
Well, this is not an election year for county commission, is it?
Is
that what it boils
down to? Well, it is an election
year. That's the problem. It's funny. Eric and I were talking about this last week after we got off the air. It's like I'm stunned by that they would go through with this in an election year because it would seem – now, of course, what is it? Five of them are unopposed.
Five unopposed.
Out of the nine. Yeah. So I guess there's really minimal risk, and that's probably why they wouldn't ahead and did it.
Yeah. You have to think if they were facing a stiffer electoral challenge. They wouldn't have.
Is there still time for an independent challenger?
So prior to this vote, Dina DiIorio, the county manager, just happened to show up in the audience at the Charlotte Squawks, which is this little thing that I'm involved in from time to time.
Shameless plug.
Heard it's terrible.
Well, we're sold out. But anyway, she showed up, and I called her out in the audience, as I often do to people who are well-known, and we had a little conversation in front of the assembled multitude, and I asked her, can the county afford this? And she said, oh, yeah, we can afford this. And later on, after the vote, she said that the changes were made to bring the county more in line with how city council members are compensated. How much do city council members make?
Well, what she really meant there was the structure, to bring it the structure in line. It's not – the amount is not in line. The amount is higher. But I think they've used that phrasing kind of as a way to kind of, you know, sugarcoat it a little bit.
Because that's how council is paid, right? They have a technology.
But it's significantly less.
Right.
I mean, the thing that's fast, or I can't say significantly, it is less, though. And I think, you know, DiIorio tends to be a pretty straight shooter. But I think in this case, it's not – I think the way it's being presented is not exactly accurate. And again, you know, can they afford it? Yes. But should they be doing this? And more importantly, again, the optics, as the Erics collectively pointed out.
CNK. You know,
you're talking about this massive jump. Why not phase it in? why not, you know, nobody goes in as just the idea of this significant a raise, just boom, is that's the optic problem. That's why the complaints are coming, Commissioner Leake. That is the question that, a lot of people have is, why are you doing this so dramatically all at once?
It does seem excessive to a lot of people, including teachers. Here's what a few of the teachers that were there had to say at that commission meeting.
I'm a teacher with 10 years of experience in the teaching field and a master's degree. After all of this hard work, I am now making what you would make with your proposed plan for your part-time job.
Incidentally, my job doesn't pay for my internet either. I can't afford internet. Our schools don't provide phones in the classrooms, so I use my personal technology to call parents, get work emails.
As you mentioned, the Observer ran an editorial about this, calling this appalling, and you threw the commission's own words back at them when they were talking about the school board request for increased funding. Out of order, the height of irresponsibility, and so politically tone-deaf, it seems downright criminal.
Oh, yeah. And what that teacher said struck me so hard that I, since teacher salaries are public information and we have a database on our website, I actually went and looked up that teacher's salary because I almost could not believe that what she was saying was true. It's true. She makes maybe about $2,000 or $3,000 more than what the commissioners will make, but that's all.
Hmm. Without the technology budget.
Not all of the commissioners voted yes. It was 6-2. Bill James was absent. Jim Puckett and Matthew Ridenour voted no. And Ridenour said that he agrees that the county commission is not a part-time job, but he indicated that he felt this increase was excessive.
I don't think that public service means that we should live our lives as paupers, but at the same time, I don't think that it means that we should greatly enrich ourselves from the public treasury.
Is that what this seems like to most people, do you think?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know.
And again, this is not Ridenour's primary source of income. Mm-hmm. It isn't anybody's sole source of income on the county commission. That's why. I mean, making $42,000 a year, that isn't the most extravagant thing you're ever going to hear about. That's why the teacher's story is so powerful. Yeah. But when that is supplementing your other income and it's – and you're doing – you know, you're elected to a public service. You're choosing to do this. Yeah. That's where the optics get blurry.
So County Commission Chairman Trevor Fuller will now make more than $50,000 a year for this part-time job, while Charlotte Mayor Jennifer Roberts makes nearly $44,000 plus out-of-town expenses. That is also a part-time position. Does this raise the question that maybe it's time in a city of this size to convert these to full-time positions? And if we do that, I think we'd be making $150,000.
Well, I think we have de facto done that. I mean, especially when you look at Jennifer Roberts's, it seems to be a full-time mayor. I think, you know, Pat McCrory was in his office a lot. I think the mayor of Charlotte has traditionally done that. But I still think that you can do that. It's not a surprise, the time commitment that you're making when you sign up to be mayor or chairman of the county commission. And I think the point that citizens are making, you know, Trevor Fuller's an attorney. He has an active and robust law practice. You know, and so I think the point that residents are making as they're so outraged is that you knew what you were getting yourself into, and so go accordingly.
Well, I think I see it a little more nuanced than that. I think that we're lying to ourselves in a way that as citizens to think that these are part-time jobs. Now, I agree
with that.
The pay raise is excessive, but we turned these into full-time jobs with some of the demands we put on these elected officials, but it's up to them to come up with a responsible pay plan and not go out of bounds as they have done with this one, I think.
The immortal words of Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. He's here with Eric Frazier from The Observer, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, and Tom Mullock from WFAE News. We will continue in just a moment on Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mecklenburg Eye Associates, specializing in treatment of cataracts, glaucoma, macular degeneration, and diabetic eye diseases. With 3 Charlotte area locations, Mecklenburg Eye Associates, 800-628-EYES. It has been 1 year since the Supreme Court's landmark ruling on marriage equality. This milestone comes during Pride Month, but also in the aftermath of the Orlando nightclub shooting. Here and around the country, there were candlelight vigils for the victims. That's a sign that the LGBT community is growing visibly in places, and actually its visibility is growing in places where not long ago many were uncomfortable being out. We're going to take a look at that growing visibility, what it means, and what the future may hold on this program Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. House Democrats stage a sit-in to push for a vote on new gun laws. Campaign finance reports show Donald Trump with much less money and staff than Hillary Clinton. And a federal judge in Wyoming strikes down an Obama administration safety rule on fracking.
The Friday News Roundup continues on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with Tom Bullock, Nick Oxner, Eric Frazier, and Eric Spanberg. Let's move on to something else. CMS did something really interesting this week. They announced their own policy for bathroom and locker room use by transgendered students, and it does not square with HB 2. What does this policy allow?
Everything that HB 2 says that shouldn't happen. It allows for students, CMS students, to use the bathroom of their choice. It allows for them to be addressed by the pronoun and the name that they choose. It disallows.
Now that's not forbidden in HB.
No. That's true. It literally just basically says, you know, we as a school district and you teachers and educators, like no more segregation when it comes to like elementary schools. No more boys' lines. No more girls' lines. Mm. And it's fascinating. I mean, it is a fascinating thing. And immediately, Governor Pat McCrory came right out and said, you know, they're absolutely breaking state
law. Breaking the law, right.
And he's right. They are breaking state law but knowingly doing so. But, yeah, I'll let you take the but.
But all of this is modeled on the premise that they are following federal law and federal interpretation of the Civil Rights Act.
And if they don't, is any of their funding at risk? Is that could they use that as justification?
In theory, sure.
Now, let's be clear here. Are you talking about the federal funding?
Federal.
On either level.
That's the case I was going to make. Federal funding, they're following the guidelines.
There's also no real enforcement of the state law, right? There's not outlined specifics on what do you do if someone's breaking the law.
Despite Funny or Die's best efforts, there are not bathroom police.
Yeah. but this is fascinating. And one thing that we've been watching, I'm sure all of us have been watching, is there may be no direct enforcement mechanism in House Bill 2, but the General Assembly has the power of the purse. And one of the things I found really I keep using the same word, and I apologize for being repetitive, but it's the best word to describe this whole thing. One of my colleagues, Lisa Worf, spoke with Dan Bishop, Representative Dan Bishop from Mecklenburg, who, of course, sponsored HB 2, and asked, all right, Charlotte they're going with the feds on this one. What are the risks here? Are there any risks of the General Assembly yanking school funding in Charlotte, which, whether we like it or not, they have the power to do? And he said he's not interested in economic repercussions. He sponsored the bill. We'll just have to wait to see. And that, to me, was really telling.
And an interesting sort of juxtaposition against Pat McCrory's sort of reaction, you know, which I think maybe says a little bit about where he is in the governor's race.
Yes.
You know, this is like this toxic third rail divisive issue, and yet he's jumping in eagerly to pick it back up and wave the HB2 flag around. It kind of sounds a little bit like he's still feeling the need to sort of gin up his base.
Well, and for a governor who was not really eager to embrace this issue, he didn't want the special session. He obviously had the executive order. I mean, there have been a number of steps where he seemed to pull back a little bit. And as you say, now he's going in full throttle.
But I have to disagree with your characterization there. You're right. He did not want the special session. But let's not forget that he signed this into law hours after.
No,
that's
true.
But I don't think willingly. I
disagree with
and
that.
And had Pat if anyone had said 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that Pat McCrory was going to be the governor who championed, you know, social issues, conservative positions on social issues, we didn't think that was what Pat McCrory was going to Raleigh to.
Right. Sure, but the fact of the matter is there's a classic stalling technique by governors who need to sign a bill but don't want to sign a bill, and that is you wait. You wait for a day.
Right.
You wait
for 2 days. I've wondered about that one, Tom, and I'm not sure where I am on that, but one of the things I wonder about is whether once it passed, even though he didn't want that special session, he felt political pressure. And this is not an excuse. I'm just sort of trying to figure out how he got to that point, whether the political pressure was, look, if I don't get on board with this thing, I'm about to get absolutely hammered by my base.
I think so. And
that's
pressure
a fair
could
point.
Have mounted, right? It could have mounted over days and focused squarely and directly on him. Or he could have done what he did and jumped right into the foxhole with his Republican brethren. But, Tom, I think the point that you raised earlier about Dan Bishop saying we don't want economic repercussions, I think that's really interesting because I think a lot of Republican lawmakers got to the General Assembly at the start of the session and said, we are going to bring the hammer down on Mecklenburg County. And then they quickly heard from people in Mecklenburg County, donors, Republicans, Democrats, everyone who said, that's a terrible idea. And so I think 2-3 months ago at the start of the session, that was definitely their plan. And I think lawmakers heard very swiftly and resoundingly, no, you should not do that. And it's interesting to see how they've backed off.
And one more thing I want to bring up too. CMS is not the only educational group to take this stance. One thing that I think has been missing in context is one of the first things that Margaret Spellings has done as the chancellor, you know, the head of the UNC system, is she has told the feds and the state and everybody else that they will not enforce HB 2 either. Now, Spellings.
And she's a conservative.
And was.
Former Bush administration.
And let's also not forget that all the protests about how she has made comments about LGBT, you know, individuals in the past. It was very controversial. And one of the first things she did was say, we're not going near this. We're not going to enforce it.
Yeah.
And that I think is probably helped bolster CMS.
Ann Clark said this is not a stance. She said these new guidelines have been a year in the making, and after several years of school staff calling the central office for advice on how to handle these young people, and she said the timing had nothing to do with HB 2. It was not a statement against HB 2, but a statement for the system's kids. She wanted to give the system some direction, but now what? Nothing?
Well, I think now we just wait and see what happens with the lawsuit.
Yeah, battle lines are drawn.
And I think, and from just strictly from a legal perspective, I think both CMS and the university system are doing the right thing. The thing that protects their
interests. Themselves. Yeah,
that's what they have to do. The federal courts, the Fourth Circuit in Virginia, they have the controlling say in this. And I think we'll find that out when HB 2 winds up getting up there.
Of course, this is broader than simply bathrooms and locker rooms at CMS because it deals with pronouns and calling people by the name they choose to be called. And here's what Ann Clark said about all this.
We've realized as a district that we also needed to make sure that our transgender students had a safe and I like to say joyful journey in CMS.
Do you think that brings that down to what this really impacts, the joyful journey aspect of this? I mean, these kids are being caught in the middle of this political hot potato fight, and she's taken out.
And Mike, in an issue that is so devastatingly difficult without those things going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is...
It's not easy being in junior high or high school.
It's not easy. And then when you have identity issues and then when you have rules that complicate those, I mean, you're exactly right. Yes, she is getting to the heart of the matter, which is how do you get children educated and how do you get them educated in an environment that is comfortable for them and not a source of agony?
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to forget with all this going on, like you're saying, that these are... There are some very real public health issue involved here. I mean, I always go back to the case of Blake Brockington, who was the first transgender homecoming king at one of these local schools, Garinger, I think it was, committed suicide last year, you know, after coming out as sort of a transgender hero, kind of standing up for transgender rights, and ultimately, you know, that's what happened. So you've got kids like this who are struggling mightily against, you know, this sort of public stigma and the weight of who they are and being sort of out of step with what the general populace thinks. And so, yeah, I think she's right. I mean, she's just trying to carve out a safe space for these children.
And that to me seems to be common sense. That doesn't seem to be infringing on the majority. I know that's where at least aspects of this argument head toward. But, you know, if someone wants identity, pronoun, those are not difficult things to provide, I don't think.
Okay. Yeah. Let's move on to something else. Yesterday on this program, CMPD Police Chief Kirk Putney spent about a half an hour with us, and we talked about a lot of things, including their Summertime Crime Initiative, which was launched in May. But one of the things we'd also talked about was body cameras and the fact that the body cams were paid for at considerable expense, so that there could be greater transparency for the public to see what actually goes on in the state of things when a police officer confronts someone, a suspect or something. And there have been complaints in the media that it's been very difficult to get the footage from these cameras. He said that the efforts of transparency are in fact working, that the people who need to see the footage can see the footage. Not the media necessarily, but if you are confronted by a police officer and you think you have done something, they have done something to you that's not justifiable, you can see the footage and you can have access to it in a court case. You're saying no.
I'm shaking my head because I think that the notion that we determine as the police who needs to see the video and who does not need to see the video is a dangerous notion. And
why do you, the media, need to see it? Why do you need to put it on WBTV?
Well, it's not just us, the media. It's us, the entire public, because trade out media for public and it's the exact same thing.
Well, why does the public need to see it? If you as the person complaining about mistreatment have a chance to see it and use it, isn't that...
No, I think the public has a right to keep their public officials accountable, and that be that the police chief, the county commission, anyone else you think. And look, these body cameras, like you said, were purchased for transparency, right? And so when you can't say city council give us millions of dollars to buy these body cams and then buy the storage system and the storage space and train all these things and then say, well, people who are seeing them are going to see them. That's not transparency. And keep in mind, there are police chiefs across the state, including Harold Medlock, formerly of CMPD, in Fayetteville, who are very for making body camera video available to the public. But let's also not forget that in North Carolina, the circumstances surrounding an arrest should be made public, 132-1.4 in the open records law. Okay, and that doesn't say just the sheet of paper that says circumstances surrounding an arrest. That says the circumstances surrounding an arrest. So if you have body camera video, if you have dash camera video, if you have any other information that documents the circumstances surrounding an arrest, which is depriving a citizen of their most basic and fundamental liberty, which is freedom, right? When you arrest somebody or when you shoot them, okay, then you absolutely should be held accountable and you should absolutely be required to make that public. And so this new bill that was passed this week, or that's moving to the floor of the House this week, says that that is not public record, and that sets a dangerous precedent for what police information is and is not available to the public. If you can tell, I'm passionate about this.
I was going to say, get off the fence. Tell us how you feel.
So here's the thing. The word, and I think the allure of police body cameras, it's not transparency. It's accountability. There is a difference between the two. And here's basically the issue. We were all sold a bill on body cameras. They came in popularity, truly exploded in popularity, after police shootings that made, you know, Ferguson a well-known household town before nobody could find it on a map, let alone tell you what state it was in. The allure is accountability, that it's not just up to some random person with a cell phone in North Charleston to record the misdeeds of police. And that it's also, and I think this is an important point, a chance for police to document the misdeeds of the public to make sure that the records are clear. So the strange thing, and I won't be able to quote the statute right off the bat, but I give you props for pulling that out.
He took your Rain Man belt and ran with it.
He did. The basic problem with police with access to these body camera footage in many North Carolina jurisdictions has been simple. They are right now largely classified as personnel records. And in state statute, personnel records, they are. That's how the interpretation is. You're shaking your head, but hear me out.
He's talking to Nick now.
Yeah, I'm talking to Nick now.
Nick the Crusader.
The thing about that is, if it's a personnel record, it's not accessible, and it's really difficult to overturn it. The bill that just passed with bipartisan support yesterday, and I believe will be in a floor vote on Friday today for the final one, and then it's off to the Senate, we'll see. It is not a perfect bill. It is not what we were told to expect from body camera, to live up to that allure. But what it does do is at least provide a legal option to challenge when a police department says, you can't see this. And there are reasons they have that. Now, I know you're shaking your head, Nick, but here's the thing. That didn't exist before. It is at least a step in a direction that if we are going to see the true You know, completion of the promise of what body cameras can do, at least it's a step.
It did exist already because, again, under 132.
Not so clearly.
Oh, no, because under 132, if you believe that any government agency is withholding a public record, which at this point is a body camera because it is subject to public record right now, it would not be under the proposed law, right? You can already go to state court and sue to get access to it. But here's the problem, is the remedy that this bill includes is to go to court and get a judge to order a video's release or authorize a video's release. That's already the only other mechanism we have in the state of North Carolina to compel a government agency to give a public
record.
Who
authored the bill?
Alan McNeil, yes. And a couple of others, Republicans actually. It's a Republican
and generally
bill.
Former law enforcement officers.
Yeah, but here's the trick with that. Right now, there's no definable reason that the police have to give to
sure,
say
132-1.4
no.
Circumstances surrounding an arrest.
Well, they're but if the all right, here's what I will say. I think the new characterizations where they have – like you can't just say circumstances like surrounding an arrest. A lot of body camera footage isn't about an arrest. Like Freddie Gray, you know, that was an arrest. But if you look at like, you know, Ferguson or North Charleston, those weren't arrests.
Sure.
Under that, if that had happened here, you could say the same thing about, you know, Jonathan Farrell.
But also
– No, hang on. Well. But now at least there is a definable series that the police have to go to basically say, this is why we're not going to allow this out to somebody to see it. Is there an informant involved? You know, is it an undercover officer? There's very specific things. I don't think it's a perfect bill, and I don't think it lives up to the promise, but I do think it is a step in a better direction.
With a mechanism that already doesn't work in this state, we basically at the end of the day, and this goes for all public records, but definitely police videos. We need a neutral or less, you know, involved arbiter that doesn't involve having to file a lawsuit to go to court to get a judge to issue a body camera. So basically, that bill says that either if you're the criminal, the person in the body cam video, a police chief can agree
not,
to release
not just a criminal, anybody who and, is captured yes, or their right, image
right,
or their voice.
Right. Then you can ask a police chief to show it to you, and anyone else has to go to a judge. It just does not make this video, which is supposed to provide transparency and accountability, does not make it available to the public.
Do you think we should let the Eric speak on this?
No, actually, we're going to go out on the porch and have a lemonade. And just, yeah.
We've been recording all of this and release it later.
Yeah, that was a great debate there, like high school square off. I like it. Yeah.
We should go to 6-2-4-16.3 I-77.
Divide that by pi, Mike.
That's right. Yeah. But we only have a minute left in this segment, but I do want to come back.
Quoting,
and,
yeah,
we can keep going if you want us to.
No,
like.
No, please. No. Please, I beg you, please, no. We're going to come back. We'll talk about I-77 tolls because it kind of died in the Senate this week, at least for the foreseeable future until next year sometime.
Probably ever.
The Whitewater Center has made news this week, and I'm not sure it's justified, but we'll talk about it. And some other things, in politics included among them because of the
– Because it's 2016.
That's right, and the presidential campaign is focusing
Aren't
on North
Carolina.
Aren't we lucky? Carolina. We'll come back with all these miscreants in just a moment or two on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and TFM Carolina's Sovereign Oaks, offering home sites shaded by forest with access to community gardens, a greenhouse, and streamside pavilion. Tomorrow's showcase event for its Brookside neighborhood, sovereignoaks.com. Well, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, the Friday News Roundup continues with the national news. House Democrats stage a sit-in to push for a vote on new gun laws. Campaign finance reports show Donald Trump with much less money and staff than Hillary Clinton. And a federal judge in Wyoming strikes down an Obama administration safety rule on fracking. Just a few of the stories they'll be talking about with Susan Page as she sits in for Diane. And, of course, the International Hour at 11 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can do it. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup or get to us on Facebook or email. We're coming right back.
Everyone has a favorite author, actor, musician, or comedian. At All Things Considered, we don't just bring you the news of the day. We introduce you to the coolest people you thought you knew and learn what really makes them tick. What you hear might just surprise you. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News, conversations that connect.
Hear the latest news from NPR, plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region on All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE.
I hate to tell you this, but the conversation continued in the break. But it's over now. It's the local news roundup.
Or is it?
Yeah, that's what you think.
I'm WFAE Charlotte Talks. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News.
Advocate for open government.
Evidently. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, who's drinking mint juleps on the porch.
That's right.
And Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. We'll keep you out of all of this, Eric. Have some modicum of decorum here. We talked a lot about this yesterday. So I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the toll situation on I-77, but the opponents of the I-77 toll lanes had their hopes dashed this week for cancellation of the contract when the state Senate refused to take up a House-passed bill on this. Construction's underway. Does that mean that the opponents will now have to wait for the long session beginning, I think, in January for another opportunity to kill this deal?
They would, except they're not going to get it then. Look, as Phil Berger, Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger, has been pretty upfront since before the session started, saying, I don't see a need to cancel the bill. In fact, I was surprised when it reached the Transportation Committee, where it could have gotten a hearing and could have moved forward.
Because we all thought it was going to be sent to the graveyard, Ways and Means,
exactly.
And nothing ever happened.
Exactly. And 2 weeks ago, we talked about this. A couple weeks ago, we talked to Phil Berger on WBTV, and he said, look, I still don't – he was non-committal then. The writing was on the wall that it wasn't going to move forward. I think it was a good attempt. It was probably the strongest attempt that the opponents were ever going to have. And I think if you couldn't get it done this time, I don't think you're going to get it done.
And here's the thing. Like, I'm not prepared to say that this fight is over, because at every step of the way, when I thought it was done, they've managed to keep the fight going and make progress. It's actually rather startling to watch. But what I will say is this – the cost of canceling this contract will only increase as time goes on, because manpower, materiel, all those things will now have to be legitimately considered. So I agree with Nick on this point. This is absolutely
– subject to a public record.
This is absolutely a major hit in that fight, and I don't think they're going to find a solution in the legislature.
I think I agree with you that the fight is not over, but the battle is won. Yeah, the battle is won, and I think that the toll lanes are built, and so that's the fate that we have.
State Senator Jeff Tartt, who switched from being a supporter of these lanes to being an opponent of these lanes, told WBTV that the problem is that the NCDOT has fought the opposition all along. You, Nick, were in Texas when Nick Tennyson, the head of the NCDOT, went to meet with Cintra. That's the Spanish company that will be running these lanes through I-77 Mobility Partners. At the time, you reported on many problems on these roads operated around the country in Cintra, by Cintra, including one right in their back door, in their backyard, Austin, Texas. Tennyson was supposed to report back on what he found during this trip. He never has.
Tick-tock.
Do you understand why?
I do not understand why at all. About every other couple weeks, I email DOT. I ask for when that report is going to be done. So, yeah, in Austin, Tennyson said, we'll have a report to you in 3 or 4 weeks.
Hey, I'm in that club too. Yeah,
exactly. He looked me in the eyes, said that, and then ran away from my camera. So, no, we don't know why he went there still, really, other than because the governor asked me to. And we don't know what he did, and we certainly don't know what he took away from that.
Phil Berger, in that comment I think he made to Channel 3 prior to the trip to Texas, said that he had not heard anything bad about these toll roads. Is that an indication? Because it was so easy to find. That the state didn't do due diligence.
No, well, it's that the state has been very, and I can show you hundreds of emails if you'd like. But and we did one in one of our stories in February where we quoted Warren Cooksey, who works for DOT, who said Cintra has, quote, and we used it in our first piece, Cintra has, quote, a track record of success. That's the narrative that they have, and we know that they've coordinated with Cintra PR people to push out one cohesive message. And so if you talk to someone from DOT, they say that, oh, this is great, this has been wonderful for the state. So if you're an elected official and you're talking to DOT, you absolutely understand why you think this is good.
Well, and what they'll say is they use very specific wording, though. They'll say that Cintra has a track record of success with managed lanes that are exactly like I-77, right. That they have not had any of those go belly up yet, which, as far as I can tell, that's actually accurate.
There's
but they
only
have
like
had
two projects
right.
That are less than 2 years old.
Right.
Right, which is why those words are chosen so carefully.
That's why I have so a perfect success at running for governor of North Carolina. I haven't done it yet, but I haven't lost.
And this is part of the argument that drives opponents crazy. I hate to use the verb drives. Actually, I don't.
terrible.
Because what happens is, you know, you have these spinoffs that are created by Centra, and then if there is a bankruptcy filing, obviously it's not hitting Centra. And so then someone has to figure out what is to be done. And that is the fear that could happen in 77.
The other interesting thing is in Texas, where Centra declared bankruptcy on the road that it managed a month after DOT told us that road was perfectly fine. And Centra is that that road didn't have a provision that said Texas had to pay for the makeup in their lost revenue, right? And so essentially, if that one goes belly up, then Texas just gets a free road that Centra built. However, every time Centra enters into a new contract, it writes new provisions that make the deal more favorable to Centra. So in North Carolina, if Centra fails to meet its revenue projections, North Carolina taxpayers are on the hook up to a certain point. And so there are big differences that have bigger consequences for taxpayers in North Carolina with our specific contract.
That's a really good point.
Let's change subject here to something that's really kind of tragic. Well, not kind of. It is tragic. An 18-year-old from Ohio died on Sunday after reportedly visiting the U.S. National Whitewater Center. It was part of a church trip, and the only place where there was any kind of water recreation was at the Whitewater Center. They claim they never went into the Catawba River, and there was no she didn't go swimming in Ohio before or after the trip. And it only takes a week for this virus or this amoeba to get into your brain and kill you. Evidently, she came into contact with a rare brain-eating amoeba. Why do officials believe that it was at the Whitewater Center? Because this is the only thing she's reporting, that they're reporting?
First of all, and I do believe with things like this, when we use phrases like brain-eating amoeba, we need to be really, really clear. The amoeba itself is not rare.
It's very common.
In fact, it's common.
It's everywhere.
In warm water.
In warm water, like
fresh water.
Yeah, like lakes, like, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. You can find this in all kinds of different places. The trick with it is most of the time your exposure doesn't, you know, like there's a very, very specific exposure that has to happen. Has to go up your nose. And they think, it's not confirmed. They're still, the CDC, everybody else is still doing testing on the water at the Whitewater Center. They think that that was the only exposure that she had to fresh water in this time. That, you know, she was rafting. You could obviously imagine that, yes, that means she could get water up her nose.
Let me ask you a question. Could it have happened in the shower? Seriously.
I can't answer that. I don't even want to postulate because I just don't know. I'm guessing not with municipal water supply because of the chemicals that are in it. But
the Whitewater Center gets its water from Charlotte Mecklenburg Utilities and also from two wells on the property, and they test it weekly, and they added extra chlorine after this incident. So if it's coming from CMP, it's the CMUD or whatever they call it today, isn't it the same thing as getting it in the shower?
Again, I don't want to – I think fear is an obvious reaction to this story, and I'm not interested in propagating fear. So I don't know the answer to that, quite honestly. But I do think that if you look at the number of people who have this kind of exposure or who have this – you know, the fatalities from this particular amoeba, it's literally something like 10 a year.
Yeah.
So the odds of this happening, the actual odds of this happening are so significantly low that I think the worst thing we need to have is just this crazy fear suddenly about water. It's a tragedy. I am sorry to hear that it happened.
So another situation with water. Ramsey Creek Beach opened a couple of months ago, and there's been all kinds of traffic problems, and they're running a shuttle bus.
It's up and down I-77.
Hold on there.
It's been renamed Centra Beach.
they're running a shuttle bus because parking has become difficult, and now I think they're talking about, are they not, raising entrance fees because it's so popular?
Yeah. And Mike, on this very show, you had questioned the popularity of a beach.
Ooh, well played, sir.
Thank you.
Ouch.
Thank you very much. Well, it just shows you what I know.
And as I join Nick Crusader in trying to fight for a better Mecklenburg, let's salute Centra Beach.
So has this been decided, and will this higher entrance fee be an impediment to people who want to drive their cars and park on the lot?
I, I'm going to play Tom here. I don't have the answer to that, and I do not want to propagate fear about entering to the beach. So
I do think it's interesting. I'll say this, that, you know, we had I've not been out to this beach, but we had because did it open over Memorial Day weekend?
Yeah. Yes,
that? Yeah. We and one of my colleagues, Sharon Smith, went out there both the day it opened and the next day and just talked about what a madhouse it was of traffic. And it's almost as though people were more in the Mike Collins camp of thinking no one's going to come to this beach. And then everyone went to the beach. And so it does seem like they've created quite a situation for themselves. That
well, I think it also speaks to how little access there is to Lake Norman, which is
a really good point, a public asset in a way, kind of.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And you know, for people who are worried, I mean, they're talking about doubling the entrance fees. It's like from $5 to $10, even more if you're not a county resident.
Yeah.
They also did something that I thought was a good move on their part, and that's the shuttle. Not only to alleviate the parking concerns, but you know, frankly, the point of a public beach is to make sure that everybody can afford it. And the shuttle, if you pay to get on the shuttle, and I think it's $3, you don't have to pay the entrance fee, which makes it less expensive for people who don't have a ton of money to
Is it true they're thinking about putting in light rail for that show? again,
just going to be a modern
streetcar.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Beach car.
Right. Governor McCrory this week signed legislation that, when combined with South Carolina's similar legislation, which they approved this month, clears the way to enforce the original 18th century boundary between North and South Carolina again, starting in January. Evidently, old surveying techniques got it wrong, so some people are going to find themselves in a different state come January. Are these both residential and business properties affected by this?
Well, officially, yes. It's kind of a pocket of residential, and there is one business that I know of. But this
gas
business,
station, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Gas the station. Single most epic like gas station fight ever. I'm waiting for someone to make a movie about this, because this gas station, because of the fact they're going to grandfather all this stuff in, its entire business model, the owner says, is basically based off the fact that it's so close to North Carolina that it's easy to go there for cheap gas, booze, and fireworks.
Can't they ask for it?
Am I wrong, Eric?
No, you're right.
I mean, that's pretty much it. So basically, this is like a 21-year-old's dream gas station. And then they grandfather all of these things in, which is fascinating to me. This one gas station will still be allowed to sell – when it becomes part of North Carolina, it will still sell gas at South Carolina's rate. It will still sell fireworks, and it will still sell booze. It is basically an island unto itself.
So they were granted an easement.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. Yeah, but a state – yeah. Spanning
and they will
easement.
Not embrace college basketball over college football. Is that right?
But the trick that this bill is really interesting too, because there's all kind of ramifications. It's not just like a tax rate. I mean, people who live in or work in Charlotte and live in South Carolina, a lot of times you hear, oh, hey, it's, you know, I pay less in taxes. So the tax rate has to be phased in. But there are also really, really interesting issues like, where does your kid go to school? And for these residents that will be affected by it, they're actually going to be, I think for a span of, I believe, 10 years, they are allowed to continue to send their kids to South Carolina schools.
Huh. The governor also signed a bill increasing the availability of naloxone. That's a drug to reverse the effects of opioid overdose. It was a bipartisan bill. It passed unanimously in the House and Senate. This creates a standing order at a pharmacy, so anybody who is at risk of overdosing or knows someone at risk of overdosing can go to a pharmacy and get this this drug. Does this demonstrate a new attitude in the war on drugs?
It demonstrates, I think, just how severe that problem has become. Yes. That it manages, unlike so very few issues, public policy issues, this one, the need is so severe and so great that it manages to sort of jump Evel Knievel style over that, you know, the vast partisan divide and actually land in sound public policy that
I also
doesn't
think,
happen these days.
I also think it's an act of compassion, a political act of compassion, because it's not just people who are known users. Anybody who thinks they know someone who may be at risk can go in and buy this. Right. And that is potentially life-saving.
Mm-hmm. And Governor McCrory, I think it might be a little bit overlooked. Governor McCrory has talked a lot about mental health and substance abuse treatment. He seems to be pretty passionate on that issue.
The struggle between the legislature and the city of Charlotte for control of Charlotte-Douglas International Airport was waiting for a ruling from former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox's U.S. Transportation Department. And this week, the FAA updated its policy on disputed management changes at public airports. And this puts the kibosh on all this.
You always wondered how Anthony Fox was going to was going to, you know, put that kibosh on it. This was pretty smoothly done, I think. Pretty smoothly
and,
done.
And the way they did it was they said they were clarifying a policy, if I remember right, HB2 has been described that way too, clarifying state policy. When political leaders get something in mind, clarifying a policy is a good way to approach it. And so what they said in essence is, if a government body wants to transfer an airport, all of the government bodies need to be share consensus opinion before they come to the FAA. And I think – I hope this isn't an overstatement. I think that the governmental bodies in Charlotte did not agree.
Maybe not.
So that's over now.
Yeah. And on the surface, it's a perfectly reasonable thing to say from the FAA's point because, you know, it prevents future – you know, dust ups like this from
but for people on the other side, you know, Senator Bob Ruccio, some other Republican leaders who wanted that separate authority, this is further evidence to them that the fix was in with Anthony Fox as the former mayor, not wanting the city to lose the airport. So,
Well, now we don't have any time left to talk about presidential politics in North Carolina, and we'll probably never be able to have an opportunity to talk about it again between now and November.
The issue's just sliding right off the table.
That's We'll talk about it again. I know we will because it's an important thing. And you did a whole report this week, Tom, on how Donald Trump is not airing any ads and Hillary is
going
around the country, which is interesting. But alas,
we have to make
no
our
time.
Brexit. Sorry,
that's right.
Cut it in.
It's awful.
Oh man,
Eric Spanbrook,
that
leave it. Business humor.
Eric Spanbrook, staff joke writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.